It is, if I didn't say this last time or the past two times, it is my pleasure to be able to bring lessons like this and really proclaim the truth to you guys amidst a lot of these counterfeits. So it is my pleasure. I enjoy doing it. So this morning we will start by way of reminder. Really helped was What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran by James White. I know he was mentioned at the beginning of this whole class, but if you know who he is, then you'll know what I'm saying. But if you don't, then you would find out that he's very, very technical. He digs into every word, every I that's dotted, every T that's crossed. So he's very helpful. Islam is a very devoted and rigorous religion, and so someone like him is very helpful. He's also done a lot of mock debates in a controlled setting. On YouTube, you won't really find a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of respectful conversations. It usually gets pretty heated between Christians and Muslims, and so when you have a controlled debate about a certain topic, and you get to stay, you don't go on those rabbit trails. James White is someone that I do refer to. So, yeah, he's got a lot of stuff on YouTube and on his website. So, just to get us started, I want to read Luke 24:27, which kind of overarches the conflicts and even the doctrinal disagreements between Christians and Islam in terms of who Jesus is. Is he God or is he just a prophet? And we'll dig more into that into part two of what they who they see Jesus as, but then also the scriptures. You'll see in just a few moments that Muslims would believe that our Bible is corrupt. It's been corrupted. It's been changed to fit a different ideal than what it originally was supposed to be. So, this is Jesus on the road to Emmaus, and this is him talk, or this is what the author is saying that is happening. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he, Jesus, interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. That is not something that Muslims would believe, that the Bible is really just about Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. Just to kind of keep some time, there's some demographic stuff, some key words. It is in Arabic language, so I'll be saying those words, but just so you know what I mean, there's a little list right there. For your consideration, this is something that's pretty important when in dialogue with Muslims. Of course, we know that there are some major informational discrepancies between Christians and Muslims. Just to be honest, most Christians don't understand Islam, and most Muslims don't understand Christianity. But being able to understand doesn't mean you have to be in agreement. You need to be fair in your arguments. You need to represent the other side well, if not better than that other side. So for Christians to be able to understand Islam and remain fair in your arguments, there are two hurdles that you need to approach. One is a time and place. Islam started in the early 600s, and so that there's definitely a time, a culture shock that could happen. The culture, which is in Saudi Arabia at that time, it must be understood for some of the actions that have taken place and some of the things that were believed. But while also understanding that that time, you also need to remember that much of those actions and behavior are not justified just because it was happening in that time period. So there is a fairness and an honesty in just recognizing what was happening, why it was happening, but also knowing that it still wasn't right. And then also the language barrier. The English language often gives inadequate translations from many languages. That's why it takes a careful study. And in this case, Arabic contains complex definitions and expressions just in one word. And so Arabic doesn't need to be your second language to understand, but just I would just encourage some more studying. And just if you hear a word where you're confused, just really dig into it to be able to understand where they're coming from. For the Muslim, I don't think there are any Muslims here, but if they do happen to listen, it is generally believed that Christianity is either Roman Catholicism or a lawless religion. It is either a religion of extreme formality, or it is a religion that allows licentiousness and even debauchery, which I think even us as Christians, we can even see why sometimes, unfortunately, we can see why some non-Christians will say, yeah, you guys are just lawless, right? Because, I don't think I need to go any further. I think you guys would know that it's pretty unfortunate that we see that. So much of Muhammad's writings and Islamic belief accuses Christianity of as being polytheistic, meaning we worship more than one God, and worshiping a man. But these accusations are really based upon a blatant misrepresentation and a distortion of fundamental Christian doctrine. And as we go through the history, you'll see why that is. So into the history, I don't know if this puts you guys to sleep. I love history. I'm a nerd for it. I do wish I had a time machine to go wherever I want in the world. The history of Muhammad and Islam is immensely bound up with the focus on Mecca, which is southwestern Saudi Arabia. Today, non-Muslims are forbidden to enter. According to Islamic orthodoxy, Mecca was an important center of religious worship dating all the way back to Abraham, our Abraham, Abraham in the Bible. It is believed Abraham and his son, Ishmael, not Isaac, Ishmael established the Kaaba, which is the site of worship to the one true God. So that's that square building in Mecca, that's the Kaaba, where everyone goes. You know, a lot of Muslims will go and kneel before it, or you know, I think they would kiss the wall or something like that. There is a window of where you look into, it's a meteorite. Off the top of my head, I can't remember what it is. I'm not even going to try to guess to lead you guys astray. But it is a very important religious site for Muslims, which again, they think Abraham and his son Ishmael built. Muhammad is considered to be the founder of Islam and was born in AD 570 in Mecca. These dates do come into play when thinking about Christianity, the conflict between Christianity and Islam. His parents and grandfather died before he was 8, and Muhammad went to live with his uncle. His uncle took him on many travels because he was a caravan tradesman. So one thing about history, I really do think the background really sets the stage of who the main prophet is. So like similar to Joseph Smith, you would know that his parents were occultists, and in that area it was full of occultism. So Muhammad's uncle is a very influential man and became vitally important to Muhammad's life and even some of the theological significance in Islam as a whole. At 25, Muhammad married, Khadijah. We'll have to go with that. She was raised by Ebionite Christians, which is a mystical Jewish sect of Christianity that deny the deity of Christ. And so I think for any of us, we would know that Muslims don't believe that Jesus is God. So you can see some influence from the very beginning. It is believed that Muhammad learned his inaccurate versions and misconceptions of the biblical accounts on his travels with his uncle and his wife. And so in this time, it is important to keep in mind that at this time Judaism was present and Christianity was very well established in the area that Muhammad was, especially in the areas that they would travel to. So it is very likely that Muhammad would have been exposed, at least through just word of mouth, He would hear tales of Jesus. He would hear even some of Jewish mythology, and just imagine you being a kid and you're at the marketplace, and even if you go to the store now and you want to ear hustle on some phone calls, you're going to hear something, but then you're going to probably miss an important part of whatever they were talking about, and you would go tell someone something even crazy, and in all reality, it probably didn't happen. So it's very similar to what Muhammad had to have gone through, just hearing all of these tales of this man who died on a cross, or even some of the mythology. And also, he would probably hear from stories from the Gnostics. To me, as I've gone through even Mormonism and Islam and as we get to the New Age, you'll see that Gnosticism plays a huge role in history as a whole. For the past 2,000 years, Gnosticism has played a big role. So apologize, my keyboard. So similar to Joseph Smith, there was an encounter with an angel. There was vision or an encounter. Instead of Angel Moroni, it is believed to be Angel Gabriel. In 610, at 40 years old, Muhammad experienced a supernatural visitation on Mount Hira. An angel, Gabriel, in human form, appeared to Muhammad and said to him, "Recite." And Muhammad responded, "Well, I'm not a reciter." And then the angel whelmed him or overtook him until Muhammad reached the limit of his endurance. This struggle, this wrestling match would happen two more times. So three times the angel Gabriel would say, "Recite." Muhammad would respond, "I'm not a reciter." And then the angel Gabriel would overtake him and really pin him down, choke him out, whatever it was, arm bars, I don't know. But there was this really violent altercation with this angel. And so after this encounter, Muhammad did fear that whoever overtook him or possessed him, that's what an actual Islamic historian would say, possessed, was a jinn, which is just a spirit or a ghost in Arabic. At first, Muhammad was hesitant and went into periods of silence, suffering concern that this was not from God at all. And in some biographies, it would say that he was suicidal. That's how much this encounter affected him. His wife did believe that it was a divine experience to calm Muhammad's fears, and she told her cousin, and he sent word to Muhammad that the prophets had encountered the same thing. So Muhammad, you're one among many other prophets that have had a visitation from an angel or from God himself. So really consider what's going on here. You may be the next prophet. And so this little title, underlined title, is not derogatory. The illiterate prophet, that is something that he was called. He was illiterate. It's a true thing. And this encounter with Gabriel is believed to be a fulfillment of prophecy found in Isaiah 29:12. And that would say, "And when they gave the book to one who cannot read, saying, 'Read this,' he says, 'I cannot read.'" Right up front, this sounds like this is Muhammad's encounter. But in its proper context, like we always try to encourage, like read the historical context, read the entire chapter, read what's going on. This chapter is just judgment towards Jerusalem. They are spiritually blind due to their rebellion. And because of this blindness, those who can read and those who cannot read will not be able to understand the book. The question is the book the Quran or you'll see it right there. The answer is no. It is actually the vision of judgment from Isaiah, and you actually see that in the verse before 12, which is verse 11. It's there. You see the context is very important. So if we want to follow this context in an Islamic view, we would see that it speaks of Israel being rebellious and blind. Therefore, to follow that Islamic logic, Muhammad is rebellious and blind. So it really, they are being more derogatory towards Muhammad than we would just reciting a name that was already given to him, the illiterate prophet. Just quickly, more about Muhammad. He is also prophesied in John, supposedly,
or it is believed, he is prophesied in the New Testament in John chapters 14 through 16. We did just go through those chapters in our main service. So I would imagine, a reason why I chose this one, because I would imagine that it's still, we're still familiar with it. In John 14, 16 to 17, we won't go through the entirety of the three chapters, but in these verses, and I, this is Jesus talking, will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper to be with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it neither sees him or knows him. You know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. Like we would believe, historic Christian belief identifies the advocate or helper in these chapters as the Holy Spirit. This is a Trinitarian, these chapters are Trinitarian through and through. The main argument from Islam is that the belief is the belief that instead of, I'm going to try, you can see it right there, I'm going to try it, Parakletos, which is the paraclete, the helper, advocate, the original, because they believe that Christians altered their book, the original had Parakletos, which means the exalted or honored one, and Muhammad was commonly referred to as the exalted one. And so some Muslims would claim that the helper must be a mere human because Jesus was. And this assertion ignores the fact that the helper is the Spirit of truth and that he will be with or indwell the followers of Jesus forever. And this is, of course, something that a mere human just cannot accomplish, cannot even attempt. And so if Jesus was prophesying Muhammad, who arrived 600 years later, then everything Jesus had said is pretty irrelevant. And so just you can see the exaltation of another prophet, similar to what Joseph Smith would be. And so now, I want to kind of follow the same method I was using with Mormonism, where this is going to be history and about authority, and then the next time we'll go through who God is and then salvation. So to the Quran, tradition says that Muhammad received these revelations directly from Allah, which contain the document we know today as the Quran. But Muhammad didn't control the frequency that those revelations came in. Classical belief is that the entirety was sent down in one night, which is called the Night of Power. There is an Arabic term for it, but I'm not even going to attempt it because I'll just sound like I'm speaking Spanish. But Muhammad received portions of the Quran over the span of 22 years. These revelations outline the message that Muhammad was called to deliver. So, which was with Muhammad amid, it was in his area, rampant polytheistic worship, rampant idol worship, and it is believed that that developed since Abraham. So it's been getting worse and worse and worse up until his time. And so Muhammad was called to not proclaim a new faith, but to reestablish an old one. His message was of pure monotheism, which is called Tawheed. And this is Allah's oneness and unity. And so that pure monotheism is the argument for against the Trinity. So they would, of course, again, believe that there is three separate deities that we would worship. So we'll get into that. We'll also get in the next time. We'll get into, like, can we answer the question: Is Allah the same God we believe in? Is Allah just another name for our God Yahweh? So we'll be able to answer. I feel like you guys would have an answer, but we'll get to that. So there was a concern from Muhammad of this idol, false god worship, and wanted to get back to one God. So there is a genuine concern that he had. Also in the Quran, I'm looking at the time. So there's a list of things that the Quran emphasizes. So that'll be for you. The nature of the Quran. It is just over half the length of the New Testament. It is divided into 114 surats, or surat, that is chapters, that plural for surah, and then in those there are ayat, and that's plural for ayah, which is verses. The organization of the Quran is not in chronological order, which may lead non-Muslims to confusion reading cover to cover. I don't know if you ever, if anyone's ever attempted it, and you get at some point, you're like, I have no idea what is happening. It's because if you're reading from cover to cover, you're gonna get confused. It jumps, you know, years from one surah to another. It can be a time span of many years. You can read something in the past towards the front of the book, and then you go, towards the front of the book, you can read something from the future, and then you can get further on into the book, and it's something about the past, and you just get all jumbled up. And so, again, it is really ordered roughly by the size of the surah. So it would go from the longest surah to the shortest. There are charts online if you ever want to read it. There are charts online that will help you go in chronological order. The Quran, it is believed that it shares an eternal tribute with Allah in that it did not have a beginning. It did not come into existence. It is eternal. And in Islamic orthodoxy, the Quran itself is given the term uncreated. And it is part of a larger portion of writings that have not been handed down. So whatever Allah gave Muhammad, there's a lot more that he withheld. And so to Muslims, the Quran is eternal. The Quran affirms light and guidance from other scriptures, specifically the Torah, and then the Injil, which is the gospel. And they were sent down by Allah as well. Although some of the, like we've said in the history, many of the stories in our scriptures are referred to in the Quran, a careful study shows that the author borrows a lot from Gnostic mythology and Jewish mythological sources to affirm the connections between the Bible and the Quran. Interestingly, Muslims believe the Bible has been corrupted and changed due to many copies of manuscripts. So the question would arise if, and this is quoted in Surah 18, if no one can change Allah's words, then how is it that the Torah or the Injil has been changed? So their claim to make a connection with us is that your Old Testament and New Testament is sent by Allah, but it's been changed. But you're also saying in your Quran that no one can change Allah's words. So did he pull his hand back and allow it to happen, or is Allah unable to stop someone from changing his words? So there's a contradiction between the arguments of Noah can change it, but then also it got changed. So something to think about as you're in dialogue with Muslims. The Islamic belief about the Bible, we would be called people of the book or people of the gospel, which is Christians and or Jews. And so the question is, did the people of the book corrupt their own scriptures? When in dialogue about Muslims, this question is of great importance to be prepared for. So there's two issues that come up is parallels and transmission, the way it was handed down. The parallels, some Muslim apologists will accuse the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, of contradiction in the events that it's supposed to say three accounts share. One of them is the raising of Jairus' daughter. Again, it is helpful to read the entire story, but just the verse that is in question is Matthew 9:18, where it says, where Jairus comes and says, "My daughter just died," and then says, "Come lay her, to Jesus, come lay your hands on her so that she will live." But Mark, which I think Mark's is longer. Either way, one of them is longer than the other. Mark in 5:23, "My daughter is at the point of death. Lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." Can we just be honest? Raise your hand if you can see the difference. There is an honest difference. There's one that's saying that she has died, and the other that is saying that she is at the point of death. Please lay your hand so that she will continue to live. Now with this, Muslim apologists will say that this proves beyond doubt that the New Testament has been corrupted. The solution would be that the three accounts for a Muslim to be, for a Christian to be able to say, no, they're all connected. They're all there is no error. It's infallible. Like what we would say, their solution would be like, well, you need to have Matthew, Mark, and Luke say the exact thing from dot to dot and line by line and word for word. In order for it to be able to be a true story, you need to have the three in exact an exact comparison. Our response would be Christians must be able to point out that, at least in Matthew and Mark, there are two different human authors with different reasons and different audiences that they're addressing. Also, the level of detail is given up to who the author is. They are not telling two different stories. Neither of them are wrong. In a group setting, we would do this as well. So I've heard with dialogues with Muslims where they would use the elephant metaphor, where you have four blind people. One is touching the leg, one is touching the trunk, one is touching the tail, one is touching the belly. Have you guys heard that one? Real quickly, has anyone heard that one? So that's used for, Christians try to use that to explain the harmony of the synoptic gospels. And I've also heard I want to say New Age, but anyone who tries to say that all religions are pointing to the same God. I just want to say that metaphor with the elephant doesn't work. It doesn't. And maybe if you guys want to ask, but maybe I'll get into that in the New Age. But a better metaphor would be if we're at a four-way intersection and four of us are at the four corners and we see a car crash. We would give different accounts. Well, I saw someone run the red light. Well, I saw that person actually stop in the middle of the thing. Well, I saw, so you see there's a cohesive, so the officer would say, okay, now I have the full story. I understand that so-and-so read the red light, he's gonna get arrested. So-and-so is, whatever. You know, you kind of get what I'm saying. There is that cohesive story. So really, it would, if I wanted to try to do this, so I would start with Paisley. We would play a game of telephone. I can guarantee that if I said something, if we get all the way over here, go back there, all the way to Dana, she would have something completely different, because one of you in the middle is going to miss something, is going to miss one word. And if, like I said, I don't like pineapple on pizza, Dana is going to say something wild about me that says I like pineapple on pizza. It's actually disgusting. But the point is that a Muslim apologist will say, nope, it has to be exactly the same. And we'll get to that I think we're going to get to that. Yeah, as we talk about the transmission. So this parallel issue, where supposedly the stories in the Gospels are not cohesive and they're distorted, that issue flows into the transmission, which is how we would get ancient scriptures, even to today. So it is believed that the Quran was recited by the Prophet, and his disciples would commit what was said to memory, and then carefully a few or maybe one would write it down. So already up front, we can kind of see, okay, if someone's trying to commit it to memory, you got to have a photographic memory, or you got to be able to be on it to be able to recite everything word for word, whether it's even the next day. I'm going to apologize if I forget your name, because I think a lot of us would even remember. I don't remember. And so there's things you have to do to be able to remember your name and for someone to be able to listen to whatever. So, David, I'm sorry, I can't commit your sermons to memory, but I can give anyone a summary of what was said. So there's already there's that comes up. Ancient texts were distributed in many ways on rocks, though they were subject to vandalism and erosion, and also hard to carry. Or parchment, whether it's animal skins, even very thin sheets of copper, or a paper-like parchment, which is papyri, but they were also a perishable medium. Some of the manuscripts of our New Testament books, the corners are damaged because it was at the end of the scroll. And so you're reading something, and you could hear something heretical if you just go to the other line, but it's missing that corner that was vital. And so to reach a large audience like us, it would require many, many copies. And so many manuscripts were not controlled in distribution, which is the main argument for Muslims that they would have against the Bible. So the fact that copies of the Gospels and the Epistles traveled like a wildfire, definitely in different languages, and they were passed on even through heavy persecution from religious entities. And so that actually is an argument for the validity of our Bible. A controlled transmission is usually overseen by an official entity, whether government or religious. It is of Islamic tradition to believe that this is how the Quran is preserved. Whether controlled or uncontrolled, both transmissions are subject to errors down the line, whether it's the next day or years, decades, there is subject to error on either side. With that, when there are few manuscripts, a textual variation can be a problem. So if four of you were to listen to me and commit what I'm saying to memory and try to write it down, there's bound to be, we can put the four up here and say, yeah, oh yeah, so-and-so messed it up, and so-and-so misquoted me, right? But then if you were to have manuscripts, you would have, in an uncontrolled transmission, you would have a wide range of location and language from early on when in its transmission. Really, the better off you will be, because you will have all of, like, let's just say, you know, 100, and there is some misquoting or whatever, but then you have, I don't know, 95% of the manuscripts, they're all saying the same thing. So you can see what's cohesive. You can see what's actually coming through. When you have two or three, you're going to be like, I can't tell if Jesus is God, or if he thinks Jesus is God, or if this guy thinks he's not. So I'm lost. This is probably a false religion. So an argument for our Bible, I was actually reminded this past week of this quote by Vodi Bakum from his sermon, Why I Choose to Believe the Bible. I choose to believe the Bible because it is a reliable collection of historical documents written by eyewitnesses during the lifetime of other white eyewitnesses, reporting supernatural events that took place in fulfillment of specific prophecies, and claim their writings are divine and not of human origin. On average, an ancient book does not have eyewitnesses until 500 years after its production. The New Testament boasts that there are eyewitnesses within the first 100 years and more within 200 years from an even wider geological area. And we do have entire copies of the New Testament from as early as the beginning of the 4th century. And in honesty, there have been altercations from early manuscripts to the popular version of the Bible that was in the medieval period, but there is no radical altercation. It is the very same ancient primitive text of the New Testament. So there is no evidence that exists of major alterations seeking to remove doctrines or insert beliefs. Everyone, up to the medieval period, everyone has been saying that Jesus is God. Just a simple doctrine like that Jesus is God. We worship a triune God. They're all saying the same thing. So a fair analysis reveals that the scribes sought their best to transmit the Bible accurately, which brings up the issue with the Quran. Is the Quran perfect as it is claimed to be? In the wake of Muhammad's death, the living prophetic voice is removed. There is no written Quranic text yet. While some verses were written down, the only authoritative version exists in the minds of a particular man called the Qurra, who memorized all of the parts of the Quran. In the midst of battles between sects of Islam, the reliability of the Quran still relied on the Qurra, pending on if they died or not, if they were killed or not. And so in that, some burnings and revisions did take place after the death of Muhammad, Uthman. I do encourage you to go to the history of this. Uthman, recognizing variations in the Quran recitation due to regional dialects as Islam spreads. So you got multiple accents, you got multiple languages coming in, and they're somehow saying different things. They're not in agreement. So Uthman saw that was an issue, and so he ordered a standardized version of the Quran to be compiled from a copy kept by one of Muhammad's wives. As this version was distributed, there was instructions by Uthman to burn any other Quranic manuscripts that differed from the standardized version that he established. And so there should be recognition that oral / memory transmission process was not perfect. We already saw that in that he saw different dialects. But like what was alluded to, Surah 6, chapter 6, and the word of your Lord has been fulfilled in truth and justice. None can change his words. And he is the all-hearer and the all-knower. Just right there, there are some quick variations. To drop down to the second one, the Khalaf version and the Hafs version, it says, "But I wonder while they mock." That's the Khalaf version. And then the Hafs version will say, it's a textual variation, "But you wonder while they mock." That right there is not perfect. It's showing that there's an issue there. It's just like if we have a version of the Bible that says that Jesus is saying, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." But then for some reason, let's say here at Christ Community, we have a Bible version that says, "You are the way, the truth, and the life." There's an equating of Allah and Muhammad. And Muhammad would find that preposterous, knowing that he was trying to establish a pure monotheistic religion, and these Christians over here are worshiping a man. Stop equating me with Allah. So yes, this is very small. I'm not going to say this, it's not the only one, but let's just say that this is the only one. You're claiming that the Quran is perfect and that no one can change Allah's words. There's an issue here when you miss just one word. And the one above, it's actually, it's an extra letter that you'll see it right there. An extra letter changes the entire meaning in English. So to end, just some encouragement for us. Since the Quran incorporates the Old Testament and the New Testament, we must help Muslims see the unity and coherence of the Bible. Both Testaments center on the person and work of Jesus. The message of the Old Testament is the same as the New Testament, namely God saves sinners by grace through Christ crucified and risen. Lastly, you don't have to be a manuscript early church scholar, although that is a fun rabbit hole to go down. I always encourage rabbit holes. You don't have to be a scholar to be able to research and come to the conclusion of the veracity of the Bible between 66 individual books over the span of 1,500 years, multiple authors written in three languages over three continents. You have 23,000 archaeological digs. None of them have been disproven. Many historical references in Scripture not found anywhere else, only later to be proven true through archaeological discovery. And the names in the Bible include specific names, places, and people. All of them have been verified. So that is our part one of Islam. It is 10:01. any questions on the Quran? If you have a question on Jesus, you know, I'll do my best to answer, but that is going to be part two of Islam. Anyone? David, I'll let you decide when to cut it off. So, Joe.
Any idea, I guess, the current form of version of the Quran that they're using now, how many original documents would they have for
them? Not many, because there wasn't even a written text even after Muhammad died. And then that was years after there was something. I don't know the specific number, but not many, because there was multiple revisions, and also a lot of the versions that were written down in its entirety or even parts of it were burned by Uthman. So there is a lost history there. And so I would have to say just not many to look from, but yeah.
You said we have full New Testament like copies from like the 4th century, right?
Or was yeah.
It, so would Muhammad have had access to like the whole, I guess, like New Testament and Old Testament at the time when the Quran was given to him?
Yeah, but again, in his travels, there was other things going on. There was Gnosticism. There was there's the Ebionite Christians. So, yeah, I mean, you could have looked at that, but it. So,
but then when the Quran is saying like the New Testament is the word of God, it would have been like that's the one that they were referring to, the one they had at that time, right?
I'm to say that again.
Like when the Quran is talking about how the New Testament is the word of Allah,
mm-hmm.
that. Like that would have been present in the world at that time, right? Like the
oh yeah, there would have been versions, or I don't think at that time there would have been a full copy. I don't know if it was in that area. I don't. It probably wasn't. There probably was distributed. You know, even some of the early church fathers didn't have a full New Testament. So there's arguments that some of the church fathers were not as fully Christian because they would say things, but it's like, well, they're actually missing this book, but they're still Orthodox. But with Muhammad, yeah, there probably was a full copy you could have referred to, but again, probably wasn't. It's not like you can go to a library and find one.
Or read it.
Or yeah, or read it. Yes. So he did. Yeah, that's actually a good point. There is a reliance on his wife, her cousin, and so yeah, and then yes.
Yeah. You said something about the name Allah.
Okay.
Should Christians use Allah as another name for God or not? Because where I grew up,
okay,
part of Nigeria where I grew up, Christians actually call God Allah.
Right. So Allah is a word for God, right? But when we look at the Quran and the Bible, can we say that Allah is the same as us saying Yahweh? And the answer is no. There actually was, just a few weeks ago, a huge discussion between conservative Christians arguing when someone just simply asked, is Allah the same God as Yahweh? And a lot of Christians said yes. So I would agree that if you were to talk to a Muslim, and you would say, well, Allah said this in the New Testament, right? I would say it's okay, but you need to define your terms. Define who is Allah, right, in the Quran, and then who is God in our Bibles. So it is another name, because it's just a word for God. But Allah to Muslims is a different God than Yahweh. I don't think it's equated, but like it's kind of like just using the King James Version only with a Mormon, because it breaks down that barrier. This, when you hear a Christian in, I guess, in areas where Islam is prevalent, and you hear a Christian saying Allah, it's a language barrier. But then they'll get into the doctrinal barrier. Thank you.
All right. I think that's probably going to wrap this up. You might have more, but grab Devin after or be ready after next week. Before you go, just a quick word. Next week is our Men's and Women's Sunday School. So you're going to have to hang on to what you learned today and then come back in 2 weeks for part of the summer. But next week for Men's and Women's Sunday School.
Thanks.
Thanks, Devin. Good job.
Thank you.
Good work, dude. I know it's hard.
Yeah.
Hard work.
This one's harder. Yeah.
I just studied the Greek War for Independence.
I'm sorry?
The Greek War for Independence.
Okay.
And, which was like in 1830 or something. But the Ottoman Turks had like invaded Greece in the early 1300s and basically like converted Greece to
Yeah. Yeah.
Islam.